I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. We've got Kyle Nathan, Draws and Fades, is back for another mailbag. Kyle, what's happening?
Not too much. What's happening with you? Why don't you tell us about being stranded on a tropical island?
I mean, you had to evacuate too, so it's been a rough couple weeks.
Yeah, you can't mess around with weather.
Yeah.
But congrats on the marriage, the nuptials.
Yeah, married man. New era. So I think the storm missed our island by like 100 miles or so. So it was a lot closer than I really knew. I looked one day, like, it started getting windy, and then I looked at the radar and saw that it was like just north of us. I was like, oh, I'm glad I didn't know that it was even like that close.
No need to panic. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, sure enough, we were flying through Miami. So an American, and, that flight, I guess, still hasn't left now because of Maria hit St. Lucia.
God, you'd have to get a passport from there.
Yeah. I would have run out of money too, because if I had to keep paying the all inclusive rate, I would have been in trouble. But it was a good little reset, and good to just chill out on a beach. And I read a bunch, and we just drank and ate a lot too, so it was fun.
That's right up my alley. That sounds fun.
Mm-hmm. So what'd you do? What'd you tell us about evacuating?
We just went up to Birmingham and hung out there. I've been there before to play a couple golf tournaments at the Country Club of Birmingham, so I knew it was a nice place, and it was fun. The drive sucked. I mean, it's like supposed to be a 9-hour drive. It took us 17 there, 17 back. It was awful, but everything's all good down here, so can't complain.
Everybody evacuating. It's like, it sounds like it's like driving in Chicago rush hour traffic for 9 hours.
Well, dude, the craziest thing was the gas. I mean, if you needed gas, it was literally an hour wait. It was insane. I've never seen anything like it. And what scared me more is you saw cars with like four gas canisters like tied to the back of their car so they didn't have to stop. I'm like, if someone rear ends them, that's going to be an explosion. Like, it's just such a... Which is scary gas situation.
That doesn't sound very safe.
No, it's not safe at all. But they're like, oh, I don't want to wait an hour, so I'll just tape it to my license plate.
it sounds like a very Florida thing to do.
Oh, so Florida. Like 74 dead as Florida man pours gasoline on his car. So bad. You did make it back for the BMW, though. What'd you think?
Yeah, I got back. I got back on Friday morning. I had a layover in LaGuardia. What an awful, awful place that is. My fiance, we got there in the morning after we flew into JFK, and I said to my fiance, I go, you know, this is the worst airport in America. And she goes, why? I go, it's absolutely awful. And, you know, the people in it don't make it any better.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
At like 5:30 in the morning, we waited an hour and a half for security, and there was literally 40 people in front of us. And we walked through, and she goes, yeah, this is definitely the worst airport in America.
Oh, that's brutal.
But BMW was good. I mean, it's always amazing. I think we talked about it in our group text, but how low these guys shoot at courses. Like, I've never thought Conway Farms is easy, and yet these guys shoot like 64 in their sleep. The conditions were, I mean, it was pretty, the greens were really firm. I think the big thing is that there's just no, you know, real, they don't have to think out there, and there's nothing, you know, that really puts the, you know, question in their head. And that's kind of, I don't know what you do to defend against these guys.
It's insane to me. I've probably played Conway, I don't know, 30 to 50 times, a lot. And I've never once walked off the course thinking it was even medium difficulty. I've always thought it's a tough course. You get through like 4, 5, 6, and you know, there's stretches of holes where you're like, oh my God, just hold on for dear life, don't make double. And you play well, maybe you shoot 68, 69 if you play a great round, for me at least. And these guys shoot 62, like 63. And, you know, if I play bad there, it's 76 in a hurry. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, I played terrible, shot 70. Like, it's just, it's insane, especially, like, to see that on a golf course that I know and that I think is hard. I was talking about it with a buddy of mine, and he's like, it's basically just what Jason Day did at Whistling. It's like, you're right. I mean, it's not as good as Day's performance, but it's crazy to put in perspective. These guys just annihilate these difficult courses. It's insane.
I mean, they just hit it so far and so straight.
Far and straight's good.
Yeah. Like, when I drive the ball well, I shoot well, but that's like, I shoot like 68s and 69s. But when these guys drive the ball well, it's 63, 62, 64. And, it's just crazy because, you know, it's what is it, 7,300 yards-ish, 74. And 7,400 yards to these guys is driver wedge fest, you know.
It's crazy. I've never thought of that. I thought of it as a long course, let alone, you know, medium. It's a long golf course to me. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I hit it, what, 275? It's not like I hit it short. I mean, I hit it short by their standards, but to me that's a really long golf course, a lot of four irons and they're just hitting, you know, flip wedges.
Yeah, there's not a lot of guys. That's one of the things I think is happening, and you see it is with the ball and the way how straight it goes now, is you see the skilled guys, the guys that don't necessarily hit it that far but are just phenomenal with every other club in their bag. They're being phased out of professional golf. Like, who's, you know, you used to have like Jim Furyk, for example, and like Luke Donald was high in the rankings, and recently
number one in the world.
Yeah, number one in the world. I mean, you go back into the era, like Nick Faldo is a perfect example. That guy didn't hit it anywhere, but he had maximum control of his ball. He could hit it all the shots. Like, he wouldn't exist in today's game. Like, if you don't hit it 310 yards or 300 yards, see ya.
Yeah, it's a shame, really. I think that it's you're eliminating, like, you know, maybe 60% of the people that are good enough to be on tour are eliminated because of that. And I don't know how to combat it. I know we have a question about the golf ball and all that. I mean, you can only make a golf course so tight, you know. I mean, what are you supposed to make it, a bowling alley with OB left, OB right, or, you know, water out of bounds? I'm not sure how to fix it, except probably the golf ball. I mean, you want to go play an 8,200 yard U.S. Open? I mean, that sounds ridiculous.
And just the fact that, like, it's not a sustainable model for a golf course. Like, think about if you have a 9,000 yard course, watering, like, and maintenance of it.
The expenses go up dramatically.
And then that 9,000 yard course is used like once every 10 years.
Right.
It's just crazy. It's I think the big thing is that I don't think narrow is the answer, though. Like, I know I'm always banging.
Yeah, you're a big width guy. But I know that's why I was thinking that's the only answer to me besides the golf ball, and I know you're going to hate that, but.
Well, here's my thought process is, like, you could create a really wide course. It could even be short. And let long hitters try and drive greens all day. Like, it could be, you could have a lot of 350 yard par fours, but let the shorter guy, because long players and short players, everybody's going to miss the fairway. You know, what kills the short players is when they miss the fairway and they're hitting four iron out of thick rough.
Right.
And long hitters are hitting wedge. Like, you can hit a wedge out of thick rough. You can't hit a 4-iron out of thick rough. And I think the width thing is interesting because what it does is it allows, you know, the bombers are going to try and drive a lot of those greens, and they're trying to up there. And, you know, especially if it can be firm and fast, they'll get themselves in terrible spots where the shorter hitter can play to his strength. They can play to angles and let their wedge game play, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of my thought process. I think about, like, the old course. I mean, is a perfect example. You had Zach Johnson win there. And it's the widest golf course in the world, and it's all about angles. You don't ever really know what the exact right way to play a golf hole is, and depending on where the pin is, it's dramatically different day to day. It's the same. You see the same at Augusta. It's a little bit less than it used to be, but those are two of the best championship golf courses ever. So if they're really wide, why do people think we need to go narrow?
Well, both of those courses, obviously St. Andrews is, they're not as fast, but they both have really difficult green complexes, and that's always a defense that, you know, we've both played some 6,500, 6,600-yard golf courses that can play really tough because of the green complexes. And, you know, if you shortside yourself, you have zero chance. And, you know, those golf courses are fun, but and they're, you know, you could do that on tour where you have the greens running 12.5, 13.5, and they're super undulating and tough to putt, but you can't do that for the everyday golfer.
No, I agree, but that everyday golfer isn't having the problems of shooting 63 at 7,400-yard golf course.
Very
and,
true.
And having an entire style of golf be essentially extinct from the game. Let's get well, I guess, what do you think about kind of the FedEx playoffs while we're on the topic? Do you think it works? Obviously, football just kills it. I mean, I'm like a huge golf fan, and if I was in the country, I'd probably watch a lot of football. I'd be flipping back and forth. Like, golf wouldn't have my full equity.
It's just, even if it was later in the season, I mean, I'm the same way. I watched all football the last weekend, you know, obviously flipping back a little bit, but it's the time, you know, football's just starting. You're all excited. You know, the Bears don't have 7 losses yet. So I'm trying to watch that game. And
they should have gotten,
you know,
7
red
losses
zone. They
the
should
West.
For that. I agree. They should have, but you know, flipping back and with the red zone channel nowadays, it's the timing. I think if you put it in, you know, not that it would, they would, but if you put it, you know, more towards the middle, more towards the middle of the season, you'd get a little more interest in it. The timing is terrible. The format's okay. I mean, it is what it is. I don't think the format is terrible. You know, we've talked about other podcasts. We like formats better, but you know, it's okay.
Yeah. It's like, I like the idea of doing a match play thing, but at the end of the day, the problem is like ratings and like having two guys on the golf course on Sunday of the season finale. Like, that's not going to work.
Right.
I see a lot of people throw out the idea of that. I think obviously moving before football will help a lot because right. It's like the doldrums of sports. But at the end of the day, I just don't think anybody, even the players, really care. Like, the top players don't really even care about the FedEx Cup because, like, it's $10 million. That's great. But, like, you know, your legacy as a player is why people care so much about the majors, and nobody's going to be like, oh, he was a 2-time FedEx Cup champion.
No, yeah, totally. I mean, in other sports, it's like, okay, what has this guy done in the playoffs? You know, Kershaw, his legacy's tarnished because he hasn't played well in the playoffs. But you look at golf, you're like, what, you know, I don't even know the results from last year, and I probably watched them, but yeah. I can tell you who won all the majors last year. So the majors are golf's playoffs. This is some kind of, I don't know, money grab, but it is something, I guess. I'm not a huge fan of it. I wish they would do something else, but they probably won't. I'm sure they'll stick with it.
Yeah, I think that $1 billion check from FedEx is gonna make him ride out this playoff
yep,
rain.
That's a good one.
It's the other thing I saw when I was researching for the newsletter that I didn't I mean I just I didn't remember it. I guess that's part of the problem. But I forgot that so you could win every single tournament you played in for a year, and you could get to the FedEx Cup finals, and they diminish your points to a set amount as number one.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't matter. Like Jordan Spieth, like the fact that Jordan Spieth could win the first three events of the playoffs, he didn't, and then not win the whole FedEx Cup, to me is just completely idiotic.
It's ridiculous. It's literally just, I mean, that's because they want the five guys to have a chance, right?
Yeah. So I mean, everybody in the field to have a chance.
That's because it doesn't matter. I mean, if it was something so significant that all these guys, you know, cared so deeply about, that wouldn't exist, I don't think.
Yeah, the other thing is trying to condense all of golf. Like, I don't know how you think about golf, but I always look at players, like even at our level, I look at players that are more consistent than me that always finish top five. And I think, God, they're so consistent. They win a couple times. They finish top five all the time. Like, that's what I want to be. Like, trying to condense golf down into 1 week or a 4 week stretch, to me, is kind of not what the game's all about. Like, Tiger always said he's chasing consistency. That's the number one thing he's always looking for, is to become more consistent. And you're trying to condense a season-long thing into 4 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between winning and third place at that level, maybe a couple of lip outs, you know, or you hit a tree and it kicks in the fairway, or you hit a tree and it kicks behind a tree, you know, that's the difference. So I'm with you. Condensing it to 1 week or even four is not great.
All right, let's get into the questions. David Horlander, if you had to move the BMW to another Chicago area course, which one and why?
A couple came to mind. The first one that came to mind is right down the road from Conway, is Knollwood. It came to mind because I played the Mid-Am in 2012 at Conway, and Knollwood was the sister course. And Knollwood, not only is it a great golf course, but the stroke average was, I want to say, almost two strokes higher. The rough was a little overgrown, but I mean, that golf course can be tough. It's a huge piece of property. I mean, there's no doubt. It hosted the Western a couple years ago, but there's no doubt it could host it. So I would probably say that's my first choice. Obviously, there's others, but Knollwood would be ideal.
Mm-hmm. I love Knollwood. I grew up working there. I caddied and bagroomed it there for like 10 years. I love that place. The one concern I would have there is just infrastructure.
Right.
Getting like the big grandstands and that's the thing I think I've realized the more I've covered golf and going to these events is like there's so few good sites available because of all the infrastructure you need with the grandstands, the length of the golf course you need nowadays, and like the type of golf course, like where so many are not available to it. So like my Conway. So the other thing with Chicago, the interesting dynamic with it is they saw it at the U.S. Open. You don't want to have a championship on the south side because there just aren't a lot. There's not a big concentration of golfers. The north and the west side are the north and west suburbs are the places where you're going to find the most golfers. And if you have it down, like Olympia Fields would be a great host, but for somebody from the north side, it's going to take an hour plus to get down there. And they just frankly aren't going to go travel down there to play. So I would look at, obviously Medina is the next host. I think it's a good host because, you know, the property, the infrastructure, like, I mean, that place can host a championship easily and has all the parking. It's easy to get to, and it's a big property. I'm not crazy about the course. It's very Reese Jonesy, but if that place got restored, it would be or redone by like Bill Corr, Ben Crenshaw, or somebody like that. That place would be a top 10 championship course in the country. Another one that it's the top of the list on everything with Chicago is Chicago Golf Club. I mean, mm-hmm. They've got plenty of space. They could actually host one of these championships, but that would never, never happen because they'd have to give up their course for a week, but they have the space and the for the infrastructure needs, and that would just be awesome. I think Conway is a good host because of where it's located. It's got the space for the infrastructure, and I think the golf course has a ton of potential to get better.
Yeah, I am with you. All right, let's go to the next question from Nate Maori. Nate, what do you think about the web tour schedule crisscrossing the nation? Shouldn't they think about the money implications on players and caddies?
Well, to say the least, the web tour scheduling is a complete dumpster fire. They started the season going to the Bahamas, and then they took a week off and then went back to the Bahamas. So, you know, like it, just from right off the start of the season, terrible scheduling with like any kind of thought to their players and caddies. Like they had to buy two round trip tickets to the Bahamas as opposed to just one. These guys are playing for so little money. I mean, you finish in 40th place on the web tour and you make like $2,600, and that doesn't even cover your travel for the week. And for the caddy, that's like, say you get 10%, that's $260 plus your like $1,000 a week fee. So, you know, the web tour, I know that are in a tough spot with sponsors, but I just don't think the tour does enough to promote how good the golf is. I think last year, between the web graduates and the finals participants, you had 9 PGA Tour winners on the season. So, like, how is this golf not being celebrated? Like, you go watch a web event, and it's just as good a golf as, very close to as good of golf as the PGA Tour. The names just aren't recognizable. So
more fun to attend too. I mean, it's much more intimate than, you know, standing 6 people back. You can, you know, walk right along with whoever you want, really, usually.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, the crazy thing I think is the misconception on the web is that it's a young tour, and it's actually turning into more of an older tour because there's so many young guys on the PGA Tour that you have all these like older guys that should still be on the PGA Tour, like if it was 15 years ago, but now they're stuck playing down there because there's just no spots for them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the reason it is the way it is, I think, is it's hard to get good golf courses to give up your golf, to give up your days for a tour event, let alone a web.com. So I think that they try to mix and match the best they can, but I am in agreement with you that they can absolutely do better, because it's not fair to these guys at all. I mean, not one bit. They wouldn't ask the tour guys to do the same thing, I don't even think, because they would, you know, bitch about it.
Mm-hmm. It's not good. I couldn't imagine being a caddy on the web tour. It would just be, I mean, I don't know how those guys afford to live. Right. Jay Rigdon, overrated, underrated, 9-hole golf courses.
I love 9-hole golf courses. I grew up, I'm going to say underrated. I grew up playing the Winnetka Par 3, probably my first 50 rounds of golf were at the Winnetka Par 3. So I love it. There's some really cool Par 3s. You know, there's one in Jupiter down here. There's one in Palm Beach that's awesome. The one in Palm Beach literally is better than most of the regular golf courses around here. They're a lot of fun. And, you know, you get obviously Pine Valley and Olympic. They all have really cool par three courses too. But I mean, I would almost prefer to play a par three course than an 18-hole course. It's just a little more fun and it's not such a time commitment.
Yeah, I love 9-hole courses because I like the idea of just playing 9 holes. Like, you don't always have time for 18. I think that we need more 9-hole. I'd love to see a 4-hole course because, like, I think golf needs to try and compete with people's workouts, you know? And people always find an hour to work out. Like, how come we can't create 4-hole courses that are really interesting and fun where people can go play 4 holes and it takes an hour on their way home from work as opposed to 2 hours for 9 or 4 hours for 18. I think you'd see a lot more people playing golf more often.
I feel like people have talked about that for a few years now, and I can't believe it hasn't really come to fruition because it's that's an answer. You know, all these what's happened to golf? How do we get younger people? Blah blah blah. I mean, that's a complete answer, and nobody's really kind of taken the ball and run with it.
It's one of the most fun golf experiences I've had this year was on my buddy's bachelor party in Portland. And he, you know, I was with like a bunch of non-golfers. Like one guy hadn't played golf in 14 years, and he's like 6'5" and Serbian. And mm-hmm. He'd only played once in his life. He was terrible, but he had a great time. We played this place, it's called like McMenamin's Pub Course. And they have a 20-hole par 3 course and a 12-hole par 3 course. The clubhouse is a bar, and you go there and you rent your clubs for like $1. You get a wedge, a putter, and one ball for $1. And then you go play, and every hole is less than 70 yards. And it goes like uphill, downhill. The greens are tiny. Like it was actually like really hard.
That's fun. So fun.
But for the beginners, they could literally hit a putter to the green. You know, if they wanted to, they could just putt it because it was like straight uphill, downhill. So you could like on the downhill ones, they could just putt it. It was really cool. It was, but like more places like that. I mean that. It had more of a Top Golf style feel in terms of like the atmosphere, but it was more golf than Top Golf.
Cool. I'm all about that.
Philip Johnson, overrated, underrated, Medina 3.
Oh boy. I'm probably going to piss off some friends here, but I'm going to say way overrated. We've talked about this before, you know, with some buddies on our thread. And I think that I would be, if I made the list of the top golf courses in Chicago, I would be surprised if I put Medina number 3 in the top 30. It's long. It's perfect for a tour event. I mean, it's long, it's hard, it's big. I enjoy playing it. It's a little boring. Some of the holes kind of seem similar. Obviously there's some really good holes, and I'm probably underselling it just because it is so overrated. But I've never been a fan of it, to be honest. So just one man's opinion.
In terms of rankings, it's way overrated. In terms of like public appeal, I feel like the internet has been so, like the internet era has ruined my Medina. Like people see it and they just, you know, and right. See pictures like that's like when people could start freely communicating about courses like across the internet with Twitter, like it's ruined courses like my Medina, like Baltusrol got the bad treatment too. But like, I mean, the design is so flawed. Like, I mean, Reese Jones puts like bunkers on outsides of the doglegs all day long out there. There's too many trees. The greens are all reased out with all these segments and all this stuff. But like I go back to the land, and the land is so freaking good that it's like almost like impossible to build a really bad golf course there. Like it's mm-hmm. still, it's a mediocre golf course right now, but the land is so good that it could be spectacular. I say underrated because if you actually renovated it and got a very good architect in there that was, you know, that knew how to build strategic golf holes, like that place would be, it might be top 3 or 4 in Chicago.
Yeah, trees is a major issue out there. There's probably 12 times too many trees as there should be.
Yeah, if they got rid of all the wrong trees and kept like those big, they have so many big oaks that are just awesome trees that, I mean, it was.
The Sergio tree is a good tree.
It's gone.
Is it really?
Well, Reese redid the hole.
Oh, he right. Cut down right, the tree right.
And he raised that green. That green's so freaking high up there.
When did he do that? I'm trying to think. When I played there, maybe 2 years ago.
That was gone then. So there's a tree that looks like you can go there and look at the tree and you think that's the tree, but it's not actually the tree.
Fake tree.
It was interesting. Okay. I busted a drive there the other day, and I think I was right by where Sergio hit his tree, which is kind of amazing given like the technology advances since that,
right.
That championship, like how far so Sergio used to hit the ball in Tiger. I think Medina is just beaten up so much that it might actually be underrated, and I'm one of the people that beat it up.
Sounds like a good answer for the people. All right, let's go. Nate Mowry, over under Wesley Bryan.
Lots of questions from Nate. Lots of good ones.
Yeah, Nate
actually
fired him off. Yeah, over under Wesley Bryan's 90-minute round of 69, which was nice.
It was nice. I think it's overrated, though, just because of what, again, what the internet does to things like this.
I'm cool with that answer. Like, all right, how about another one from Nate? What are the three worst best courses on tour? Which courses would you substitute in?
Three best would be probably, let's see. I mean, like Aronimink next year has got to be in there.
Aronimink is so good.
Riviera every single year has to be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would probably say, well, Trinity, I'm going to be really interested to see Trinity Forest in Dallas next year.
Mm-hmm.
New host. I don't know who I'd say for the third. I'd probably, I mean, Pebble Beach, but they don't do the full hosting, you know?
Right.
I'd still say Pebble Beach. What do you think?
I can't leave Pebble off there. And Aronimink is one of the best courses I've ever played. That course is amazing.
And it's gotten better.
We did a trip there and we played Pine Valley the day after we played Aronimink. And not to say that Aronimink was better than Pine Valley, but we were like, wow, those courses, they're not similar by any means, but in terms of how we rated them, we're like, wow, those courses are not very far off. And we had no idea anything about Aronimink.
We got to do a trip to Philly before that BMW next year. Get a little Aronimink in and there's so many good golf courses in Philly.
So many. It's crazy, actually.
I spent 2 weeks there last year, and I feel like I just scratched the surface.
I haven't played Marion. I'd love to. What are the worst courses on
worst
tour?
Courses? Ooh. First one that jumps to the top of my mind that I kind of lit up this year is Glen Abbey. I mean, it's hardly one of the best 100 golf courses in all of Canada. I don't think it would be. And you look at it favors the long hitter tremendously out there. If you don't bomb it, you have no chance. And you look at what just happened to the Canadian Open. I mean, it used to be a major, major event, and I mean, Jack Nicklaus, it was one of his like must go tos every year.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened to it is it's become like a bottom tier event. Since, you know, the slide started when they started going to Glen Abbey. I think you look at good golf courses usually promote good fields. Like Riviera, obviously LA has a part of that, but it has the best non-major, non-WGC field year in, year out, and it's the best golf course. So that's a quick fix for the Canadian Open, and I know everybody will say they don't make any money if they go somewhere else, but it's not like you can't just like go somewhere good 1 year and have all of your problems fixed. If you continually play good courses, it'll get fixed. Firestone, I hate Firestone. I know good players win there, but it just, it's thoughtless. It's, you know, hit it straight and hit it close. Like there's never any, like in what holes can you remember at Firestone? Like you remember them because Tiger played 18 in the dark, and you remember 16. But could you tell me what hole 7 at Firestone is? And they've been playing there for how many years straight? And it's right. A big-time event. And then I got to go with the Jones family legacy here, the RTJ trail for Barbasol.
All over the Joneses today.
Yeah, tough day for the Joneses. but I would say I'd say that just because, like, why are they playing in Alabama in August? Like, the course probably is okay, but the fact that you're playing a golf tournament in Alabama in August is asking for many rain delays and like extremely soft conditions and players just like with tons of swamp ass.
The one course you're leaving off that list is TPC at Scottsdale. That course is awful. Maybe I'm salty because it's like a few hundred bucks to play, and you get out there and like the first 14 holes, you're like, what the hell is this? Like, I could have just, you know, played the hotel course or any course, you know, in Arizona. That's literally so boring. The 15 through 18 are cool, but I think you're so bitter that you've played the first 14 holes. By the time you get to 15, 16, 17, 18, you don't get to enjoy it.
I got a lot of heat even from one of our friends, the angry golfer, when I said that Scottsdale, TPC Scottsdale, is a below average course in a city full of average golf courses.
Yeah, I think you're painting that in a positive picture. I think you said like Scottsdale is one of the worst golf cities in the country, and then said like Memphis was better.
I didn't say Memphis.
No, you didn't. But your argument about Scottsdale was good. But excuse me, about TPC at Scottsdale. But I do think there's some awesome golf courses in the Scottsdale area.
I need to go.
It just might be a little overrated because there's so many and people are like, oh, Scottsdale, golf mecca. It's definitely not that. But it's not terrible, I don't think.
I always judge golf cities like how many courses would you fly there to play? And like from what I haven't played enough golf in Scottsdale. I have to go this winter. I think that's something.
Have you played Desert Forest?
No. So I haven't played enough.
That course is amazing. But that's a northern golf course. It's just kind of placed in the desert, but it is it's kind of a northern feel to it. But they have some really good golf courses.
Whisper Rock is like a cool experience more so than being a great golf course.
Oh, totally. I would give the golf course like a 5. I don't even really remember many of the holes there, but I remember the milkshakes and the hanging out inside watching. I think it was NCAA tournament last time we were there. That was a blast, but the golf course was kind of eh.
So I always judge it on like where in the city would I, like, you call me up and say, hey, I'm playing here. Like, where would I hop on a plane, no questions asked, to go play? And, you know, Chicago has Chicago Golf, Shore Acres. Like, Columbus has Muirfield Village. I'd probably get in a car to drive Scioto, but like the golf club, I'd get in a plane and go fly there to play. Like San Francisco has San Francisco Golf Club. You know, they have, I'd probably go play Cal Club also. The Olympic Club, obviously. So like these cities, LA has 3 courses I'd get on a plane to go play. Like, that's my point. It's like there isn't one in Scottsdale where I'd be like, yeah, you know what, I'll drop everything and go play. Pennsylvania, I mean, like Philly, Pittsburgh has them. New York, Boston all have them.
No, what? I mean, I think I agree with you that it's not very top heavy, but it's a little deeper.
Here's a good question from Joe Estes. Best betting game with players of varying skill level?
I would say the banker game would be the best, because you can do it with guys who are 20 handicaps, plus fives, and you can win, you know, you can bet as much as you want or as little as we want. Brief synopsis. So you go to a hole, say the guy that hold the first putt with the lowest score is the banker on the next hole. So say I'm the banker. I say, okay, this hole's worth $40.
Maximum, and right?
Maximum. And you and me are playing straight up, and you say, okay, I'll take all 40 of it. And then our buddy's getting, you know, 8 shots, and he gets a shot. Or you want 20 of it, say. And then my buddy's getting a shot off me. He wants all 40. And then, you know, one of our other buddies is just tagging along for fun. And he just says, okay, I'll just play it for 10. And then you just play the whole individual, me against you, me against the other guy, me against the other guy. That's kind of a brief synopsis, but it's good for all levels of betting and all skill levels.
You know what I really like about that game is if you play well, you're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very simple. Like, if you shoot 68, you're going to win. You know, if you play a great round, if you're a 12 handicap and shoot 80, you're going to win. Like,
right.
It's not going to be where, like, one hole, like, can just railroad you, and you could, you know, you make your only bogey on a hole, and somebody else makes an eagle, and you lose 500 points. And it's just like, well, I just, you know. So that's one thing I love about that game. I think it's good for different skill levels. We played it with a not that vast, but a pretty vast.
Yeah, we played it with a good group of guys, diverse handicaps. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I think Banker, I think Wolf is decent. Obviously Scotch and like Vegas skew to the better player.
Yeah, that game's all about procs, so you don't want to get in that game with, you know, if you're a high handicapper, you don't want to get in that game with low handicappers.
And it's like, I think the traditional Nassau, like, actually skews, like a match play Nassau skews to the higher handicap having an advantage. Because
oh, totally.
Because as a lower handicap, your variance, like, you know, you don't make many doubles or triples, and a 15 handicap can make 9 pars. But he could make, you know, 3 triples, and those 3 triples you can make birdie, and, you know, you pick up 12 shots on those 3 holes, but you really only win 3 holes. So
yeah, it's a story for a different day, but I've always felt like member guests and, you know, stuff like that, where it's usually best ball match play, it should not be even close to 100%, probably not even 80% of your handicap. It should be like 60, but
yeah, I think like 60 or 50 it should be. But that's, both of us have an extremely biased perspective on the subject. So, Philip, why did Leishman get 2 trophies? That's because there's a BMW trophy and a Western Open trophy. So, like, you know, the WGA runs the Western Am, and it became the BMW, or the Western Open, and became the BMW. And, you know, the Western Open was one of the most historic events. It's kind of a shame, actually. But the better question here was overrated, underrated guys who play with no hats.
I think overrated because you're probably not that intelligent, because with, you know, melanoma and you spend so much time on the, you know, in the sun, not wearing a hat is extremely dangerous, and you're just not intelligent. If it's one thing if it's like once every 2 weeks, but once every 3 weeks, it's still not good. But if you're out there regularly playing golf without a hat, you gotta fix that. You gotta figure it out.
Sounds like you should get in with the big safari hat.
I should. The long sleeve shirt. I probably will be. I think that's what people do in Florida after they've been here for like 10 years. I'll be wearing like long underwear and my legs. On my face.
I'm gonna go underrated on the no hat, and it's just because I admire them not selling out and earning the extra whatever couple hundred thousand, or, you know, if it's a high profile player, millions of dollars from a sponsor by foregoing the number one spot on a golfer.
All right, how about Blake J wants to know your thoughts on the new Dana Fry course at Arcadia Bluffs?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so it's hard to say what my thoughts are. I like the idea of getting golfers more exposed to the kind of Rainer McDonald style of golf in a public setting. There just aren't many of them. It'll be interesting to see how it's executed. I think the tough thing with doing that style of golf is where Rainer was really great was like in these small little intricacies, like, you know, it's like these small little internal contours and greens where if you miss the green, you know, if you're pin high right, not only do you have slope right to left, but there's usually these little tiny spines that you have to putt over that all of a sudden make speed control impossible. So I think that is the genius of Rainer that will be very difficult to match, but I'm excited to see it. Dave Essler, who I had on the pod, did a great job doing a course in a similar manner from like a nothing muni in Mount Prospect, where you have these wild template greens, and, you know, there's something that he faced there was backlash from the public because they didn't understand it. So a lot of people think like these are goofy greens, but these are the whole premise was like build a public course in Chicago where you can see the architecture you see at Shore Acres and Chicago Golf, the two best golf courses in the city.
Mm-hmm. That leads us Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
That leads us to the question here about Mount Prospect Golf Club versus Ravislo. What are your top five public courses in Chicago, considering the quality of course, cost, distance from the city, etc.?
So if you do the cost, I think this is the only way you can really judge like golf in cities is when you do quality of course, condition, and the cost, because. You know, if you play a course, if you want a course that's great conditioned, like I, you know, you can tell, hey, if you want great conditioning, you should go play the Glen Club. But I don't think it's anywhere near the best public golf course in the city.
Right.
What I would say is I'd probably go, Ravislo is my favorite place to go play. It's like a Donald Ross course, great greens. It, unfortunately, they can't keep the greens. This is the other problem with public golf is like those old greens, they can't keep fast in a public setting because the rounds would just take too long. Guys would be putting balls off the green all day. Whereas a country club, you could do that because people are more used to the green speed. So I'd say Ravislo is my number one. I'd go Mount Prospect. All right. I'd go probably Shepherd's Crook number two. It's way up in Zion, so it's far. But that's an awesome golf course. There's no range. It's built on a landfill, so it can kind of smell sometimes, but it's a really good golf course. And then I'd go number three, Mount Prospect, number four, Highlands of Elgin, and I don't know what my number five would be. What about you?
I like that list. I'd probably put Pine Meadow in that list.
Pine Meadow's cool.
I like that golf course. I mean, I don't know how architecturally sound it is, but as far as a public course, I mean, it's tough and it's solid. I haven't played there in years, but I want to say it's probably around $100, something yeah, like that.
It's a good deal. So the interesting thing about Pine Meadow is that it was originally designed by William Flynn, the guy that designed Shinnecock Hills.
Jesus, I did not know that.
Yeah. Catansett, the country club. I mean, it was integral in Marion and Pine Valley. This guy came to Lake Forest to build an estate for this guy named Albert Lasker, and it was called Mill Road Farms Golf Club, I think that was the name. But anyways, it was apparently this golf course in Lake Forest. He built Pine Meadow at the same time. This golf course in Lake Forest was the Oakmont of the Midwest, and there was an ongoing bet that Lasker had with any tour professional that they couldn't come and break par. And he would give them $1,000 if they broke par at the course. And I think only one guy did it ever. But then Lasker died and it became a housing development. And, you know, Lake Forest lost probably the best golf course in the town, in the city. Maybe.
Brutal.
Maybe the city. Maybe it probably wouldn't have been better than Chicago Golf. But
sounds like Jerry Rich. He has a standing offer to try to break par at Rich Harvest from Neat Tips.
Yeah. It's probably a little bit different test of golf in terms
right.
of what it demands. Let's see. Is there a golden age course not in the USGA ROTA for events that aren't US Open, Mid-Am, all the AM events that should be? Do you know what
that is? Why don't you take that one? That seems right up your alley.
I feel like the USGA gets their kind of pick of the litter, but I don't know the last time like San Francisco Golf Club had something. And I think that would be a great golf course. Obviously, you've got another one might be like Peachtree. It hasn't ever really had anything. I think these clubs probably aren't interested in hosting them more
right.
so than but those. And I think like San Francisco Golf Club, given its lack of distance, you'd have to have like a mid-am at. The best course that I've played this year, not named Chicago Golf Club or Fisher's Island, is a place called Moraine. And it's in Dayton, Ohio. It's neighbors with NCR. I played a US AM qualifier there. So it's not the USGA run event. It's a local golf association run event, and only one guy broke par over the two rounds. It wasn't like abnormally windy or bad conditions. It was a good day to play golf. So I would say Moraine should be hosting something. It should host like a senior open a senior players, like if the tour wanted to go there, or it could be like an awesome USAM host with NCR as the other course, or a mid-am course with it and NCR. They literally are, they butt up against each other. So that could be a really great kind of combo. Here's a good one. Overrated, underrated practice swings.
I'm going to say overrated. I only say that because I think it's such a perceived notion that you have to have this two swing, three swing routine. And there's been times where I've struggled playing and I'll switch up my routine. I mean, and maybe go no practice swings and you play fine for a little bit. So, I mean, as long as you're loose, I mean, it depends if you're rehearsing something, you know, like trying to get under it or come over it, whatever you're rehearsing, then practice swings actually help. But if you're swinging it pretty well, I'm not really sure. I mean, what they do for you.
Mm-hmm. Some people say that your best swing would be your first swing because it's mm-hmm. the most natural and instinctual. I'd say overrated. Not necessary. Here's another good one for you. Should the Walker Cup reserve a spot for a mid-am or a senior am? And a senior am?
I think I said this on the last one, but no, I don't think so. I mean, I think it should be the 12 or how many? 10 or 12?
10.
10.
I think they should expand to 12, though.
If you expand it to 12, I think you could, you know, you'd have some wiggle room there. But I think if it's 10, I think neither. I think you should just have the 10 best players. And like I said on the last one, I hope it's 6 mid-ams. But, you know, if it's not, it's not. It should be the 10 best players that play in it.
I agree. It's not like they, I guess, you know, this year the President's Cup took Phil, which was kind of like taking a mid-am. He probably didn't deserve to be on the team. let's see. We'll say overrated, underrated Midwest Fall Golf from Andy K.
So underrated. I love Midwest Fall Golf. I'm trying to figure out a few dates in October to come up north and play Exmoor and all the good golf courses that are it's when it's firm and fast up north, typically the courses are just so good. I it's my favorite time of year. There's nothing to me better than playing like a 8 o'clock round on a Saturday and Sunday, you know, eating lunch, going home and just watching football all day. It's like a dream day.
Yeah, especially when it's the weather where like you're wearing pants and a pullover mm-hmm. when you tee off, and then by 8 your pants and a shirt, and it's just like that perfect weather. It's a little mm-hmm. brisk and the ball's running. The greens are flying because they don't have to worry about all the diseases getting in there yep. with like the humidity. I mean, there's no way it could be possibly overrated.
Agreed.
What's the craziest confrontation you've ever witnessed on the golf course or had?
I saw this question. It reminded me of one thing. I was playing a high school match with my buddy Andrew. We were playing... I guess I shouldn't say what school. So what school we were playing against, but we were both playing for New Trier. And one of the guys we're playing against is clearly moving his marker up. Like every time he puts it down, he moves it up like literally like 6 inches to a foot. I mean, we would turn around, talk to each other, and he'd have like a tap in instead of a 3-footer. We're like, what the hell is going on? So Vit's like, okay, you know, I'll you know, I'm gonna keep an eye on him, blah blah blah. So I'm not really paying attention on like the 7th hole. I look over and Vit goes up to this kid and he goes, listen, I saw you move that marker. I'm not going to call you on it, but if you do it again, I'm going to beat the fuck out of you. I was like, oh my God. And the kid got ghost white, literally made, I think, double or triple on 8 and double or triple on 9 after being like even par. It was the craziest thing I've seen. He was so flustered. It was amazing.
Yes. It's the high school golf. Lots of
High school golf can get crazy.
Yeah, mine would be I was playing at my home club, and I sprayed one. I was actually somebody else sprayed one into our fairway, and I pointed out. I was like, "Here's your ball," And the guy, like, drives up with his cart, and he, like, immediately starts, like, getting ready to hit the shot. And I'm walking, like, directly in front of him. And, like, all of a sudden, I'm, like, standing right in his crosshairs. And I'm like, holy shit, this guy's going to hit the ball. And I start running with my bag on my shoulders. And he hit he chunks it. And he was, like, this big guy. He chunks this. And it, like, goes, like, you know, like, right in, like, 30 yards. And I'm like, holy shit. And I said to him, I was like, dude, you got to wait till people get out of your way. And he goes, you thought I was going to hit you? And, like, I was pretty pissed off. So I said, well, with a swing like that, you'd never know. And, I mean, this guy got, like, enraged. And he was...
Was he hammered?
No. He's this big guy. He was tatted up. And my buddy I was playing with, like, dude, like, why'd you say that to him? But, yeah, he got really mad. I actually kind of was scared about getting my ass kicked on a golf course, which I didn't think would ever happen. Let's see.
How about overrated, underrated wedge stamps and Adirondack chairs?
I think they're both overrated. I had a buddy give me some, Wilson wedges. And they have my initials on them, and it's cool. But like, I don't get in on like the designs. Like a cool putter cover doesn't get me going.
Or right.
I'm like kind of more of a minimalist. And then the chairs, I think that like people make such a big deal about them that they're overrated. I just naturally think things are overrated when people like them.
I say overrated wedge stamps and. I guess underrated Adirondack chairs because I like saying Adirondack.
They are cool. Like Arcadia Bluffs has a bunch of them that on top of the bluff and they look out over the lake. Like that's fucking awesome. I'm in on that. But
you're in on that?
Yeah, just in general, maybe out on it. I don't think they're that comfortable either.
They're okay. Yeah, you're right. They're not like it's not God's gift to comfort.
They look cool, but you know, I have this. Debate with my wife all the time. Like, they look cool. Like, this looks cool, but it's not comfortable. Like, that's the main point of a chair.
Right. That's a good spousal argument.
Yeah. Let's see. What else we have? Okay, here from 16 pars, it looks like he had an interesting experience in his mid-am qualifier. He's downwind, 276 pin, 240 to carry on the 18th over water. It's a par 5 and it's a very windy day and he's the second to last group with no live scoring and he's 2 over, you know, with 2 qualifier spots. What would you do?
I don't know if I have enough information there. I think you need to know I'd like to know where, you know, I think he probably had hopefully a general idea of who was in the field. And it depends on where the wind is. I think that if you can hit it 250, you go for it. But if the 240 yardage is right on the border, I think you have to try to lay up and make birdie the other way. Because there's nothing worse than, I did this in a Monday qualifier for the Greater Milwaukee Open. I think I was 3 or 4 under maybe. Maybe 5, I forget, but I'm on Monday qualifying and I'm on the 18th green and I look at my buddy who's caddying for me and I'm like, dude, I have like a 30-footer downhill. I'm like, dude, if I make this putt, I'm going to play in a tour event. He's like, yeah, yeah. So I'm like, I ram it 10 feet by. You know, I'm like, oh, man, come back, miss the comebacker, tap in. Had I just two-putted, I would have been in a playoff. So you never want to, you know, count your chickens. Unless it's you can miss it and hit it 240, I would probably lay up.
Yeah, I think in general, thinking numbers is the complete wrong way to play a qualifier. Something that's helped me recently with qualifiers is that I don't think about my score. I just simply say to myself, am I playing well? And if I'm playing well, no matter what my score is, I'm probably going to be very close or like, you know, if it's at a state level, I'm going to get in. At a USGA level, I'm probably going to be somewhat close and I just need some putts to go in. So, because like, you don't know what this number is ever going to be. And even thinking about the number is just wasting your time and taking you out of what the psychologists say is the moment, you know? So I would say that the first question I'd ask myself is, especially like on a windy day, am I playing very well? If you're playing very well, you're probably in a good spot. Like I think back to like the Lakeshore mid-am thing, like where I played really well last year in this mid-am thing, and I shot 70 on a really tough windy day. Like
I that was a good round.
Walking off that course, I would never think like on a regular day like 70 is going to be the medalist. It ends up being the medalist because it was a tough day, but I knew I played great golf. So it's like a number doesn't really matter. It matters how you play.
Right. 16 pars, please tweet us and let us know what you did. I'm curious to see how that ended.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a couple more and we'll get out of here. We touched on the ball. Let's do... how about we say overrated, underrated playing tournament golf from some guy named Tony?
Well, some guy named Tony, I think playing tournament golf, I want to say I think underrated. It's really fun to compete and not necessarily against other people, but it's fun to see how like you mentally handle situations. I think it's beneficial to, you know, as a trader, it's beneficial to me to know how I react to certain things and can I, you know, keep cool and calm when things aren't going right. So I think it's underrated. I think it has value to other parts of your life. I think that, you know, you make a lot of good friends. So I'm going to say underrated.
Yeah, I think underrated too. I think it obviously helps your golf game. I actually have like a problem now where I don't play as well as a casual golfer as I do as a tournament golfer because I just don't focus. But that's fine. I'm not out there playing on a Saturday morning to like grind out a score. More so to have fun. I think I completely agree with helping other parts of your life. Like I used to be in sales and just like being calm. Like that's the biggest thing. You know, I used to run a little hot on the golf course and now I mean, you eventually realize like it doesn't really matter, but it helps you with other aspects of your life. Like, you know, you have to stay cool.
Provides discipline too. I mean, I know that you're probably not going to have 14 beers with a 9 a.m. tee time in a tournament the next day. So, you know, you got to go to bed early on a Friday night and get ready to play the next day. So I think it helps discipline.
Yeah.
Keep you disciplined.
Ryan Hennessy, this is a good question. Why doesn't the low am at the Masters get an invite to the next year? Is it because they assume that he turns pro after? Obviously, it's pointed to Big Stu.
I'm curious if they assume that. Obviously, we don't know. I guess they probably do. I think they should. They're very obviously very pro-amateur, and I think they could put a caveat in there that the low am gets an invite next year, provided he's still an am. That would be interesting because it must be such a cool experience that guys might even hold off on turning pro. I wonder if that would, you know, it's just... You know, you play well in the, you know, you're low am, that's fine. You play well the next year in the Masters, you know, you could make millions in sponsor money versus, you know, grinding out a year on, you know, the mini tours. But I think I'm all for that. I think the low am should get an invite the following year.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think a lot of people would stay pro. Like, I think it's just cool for a guy like Hagestad. I mean, obviously, he, nobody expected him to be the low am at Augusta, and he played great golf for 4 days. And the fact that he is still amateur, like, why wouldn't you get that? And it would be for like cool pairings. Like, obviously, the US Am champ gets to play with the reigning Masters champ, and is it the US Open champ?
Yes.
And so, like, that's cool. But then you could have like the low am gets to play with like the USAM runner-up and somebody else. So maybe you do the USAM runner-up and the Masters runner-up from the year before.
That would be cool, for sure.
So I'm in on that. All right, let's...
How about this one from Will? Says, "Hi, Andy. I had this discussion recently with a friend. I'm about a 10 handicap in my mid-20s. If I quit my job, hired one of the top swing instructors in the world, and worked on my game full-time, how good could I reasonably expect to get in X amount of time? A year, 3 years, 5 years? Assume money isn't a problem as far as equipment and course access goes. Could I expect to get to a PGA Tour level of play, web tour level, or just be a really good amateur at my club? How much of golf do you think is natural talent and ability versus dedication and practice? Enjoy the pod. Keep up the good work. Will."
All right. This is a great question. And I think, you know, I think some people have tried to do this. Now, I would say that you're never going to get to a web tour level or even like a Latin American tour level. I think your swing's going to have some flaws that are going to take a very long time to fix. And the biggest thing is that you've missed out on reps for 10 to 15 years that those guys have had. And not to mention all of the tournament golf experience. Like, that can't go without, you know, like, you can't overrate that enough. So I would say that you're never going to get to a pro golf level, of a touring pro golf level. I think you would become very good. I think a year in, you could probably expect to be down to a 4 or 5 handicap. I think 3 years in, you could be a good state level amateur player. And I think 5 years in, you could begin to, you know, be playing in, like, have chances to play in, like, the U.S. Mid-Am at that level. What do you think?
I'm going to say I'm not I think that you're right on the PGA Tour web tour level. I don't want to say it's 0% because there's always a chance, but I would put it under 1%, you know, from a 10 handicap. I think, you know, it's hard enough. I know some guys that have been, you know, plus ones, scratches, plus twos, and tried to do that. And, you know, they haven't had much luck. So coming from a 10 without the reps that Andy mentioned makes it even harder. I think in a year, golf's a hard game. I think in a year you could go from 10 to 4 probably, and then 3 years, maybe 4 to scratch. And 5 years, you could probably be playing in state tournaments. I don't know if you could be at the top of that, because you are competing against guys that – practice a lot and they've been playing tournament golf for 20-30 years, so it's tough. I mean, it's definitely doable though. I mean, it's not — that's what's so great about golf, is you could you know, be one of the best senior AMs in the world in 25 years. There's no doubt about that, but in terms of it, within the next 5 years, I think that's tough.
So like a good example, I have a buddy, friend of the pod, his name's — he played minor league baseball. He's a buddy of a buddy of mine, like from high school. They played high school golf together. So he was a high school golfer. He was, you know, once upon a time a 2 handicap in high school. And he played minor league baseball. And I remember playing with him right after he quit minor league baseball. And he was like a 6 or an 8 handicap. Like, he wasn't, you know, great, but he had, like, he murdered the ball. And within 2 years, he was down to, like, a 2 or a 1, like, back to his high school level. And within 4 years, he was at a plus handicap level. But this is a guy that was already had a lot of the reps and the skill, but, you know, had fallen down because of a lack of playing. So, and he has a ton of athletic ability. Like, he hits the ball like 350 yards. So that's — I would say, I think you're right. It 5 years, you're probably a state competitor with like a very outside chance to qualify for like a U.S. Mid-Am.
Mm-hmm.
So
on this question though, is it Jason Bone? Did he do this? Didn't he make a hole in one? Or is that who I'm thinking
Scott
of?
Scott Piercy.
Is Scott Piercy?
Didn't he? Scott Piercy, I think, was trying to play pro golf and he won like a $1 million thing in Vegas, and that's how.
That's different. I think Jason Bone, if I'm right, I know somebody. I think it's Jabone. You know, made a hole in one, basically quit his job and worked real hard for a few years, and made the tour. But I think he was obviously a great golfer beforehand. Maybe not. Maybe, you know, the money was a big hindrance to him getting to the next level. And then once he got it, he was able to do it. But I feel like that's right.
Yeah, I think if you're like a plus three and it happens, like, or a plus two, like, you've got a small chance, but
it's still so. I you know, I have buddies. I'm 33 now, so I graduated 11 years ago. I have buddies that I graduated with still playing mini tour golf, and they are playing, you know, full time for 11 years. Great, talented players. And still, you know, haven't played on the web or PGA Tour. So it's just, I mean, to expect to do that is not in the realm of happening.
That's like the possibility. Nobody understands. Like, you know, like I played with a buddy of mine who's played full time on the web this year, and I played really good golf and shot like 71 that day, and he made a double bogey and shot 67. And
who was that, Vince?
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, like I don't have that in there. I always say that they're like a deep, they're like a nuclear sub. Like, they get under the water and they can go as low as they want. And I'm a snorkeler. So
just dabble a little bit.
I can get down there. You know, sometimes I spend a lot of time above water. And then when I get below water, like, if I get too far under, like, I'm getting water down the snorkel tube, and I'm
float up.
I'm coming up.
I like that analogy, snorkeler.
So, all right, I think that's we got to most of it. Thanks for all the questions.
A lot of good ones.
Yeah, if you want to, you know, we do this pretty regularly, so if you want to, you can email them to us too if you have a longer question. If you just tweet at me, I'm not very organized. So if you want a question, and the best way to do is email. If it's not associated to a thread where we ask for questions. So, Kyle, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to have you back.
Hey, it's glad you're safe and sound down there in Florida. And
thanks.
All right, later.
See you guys.